Hey, thanks for checking out Here and Now Anytime. We've got new episodes every weekday, so be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, follow us on Spotify, or keep up in your podcast app of choice. Just look for Here and Now Anytime. And thanks. Now here's the show.
I find hope and beauty everywhere. I think that people in the city are anxious to move forward, anxious to come together.
Our interview with the new mayor of L.A., Karen Bass. It's Tuesday, December 13th, and this is Here and Now Anytime. I'm Chris Bentley. Today, we hear from one of the scientists behind a breakthrough in fusion energy. And we've got a recipe for fish curry that stirs up childhood memories for a few folks on our staff. But first, Karen Bass was sworn in as the new mayor of Los Angeles this week. And she spoke to Here and Now host and former Los Angeles resident Deepa Fernandez about the challenges facing the country's second biggest city. Let's get right to that interview. Here's Deepa.
Mayor Bass, on your first day on the job, you declared a state of emergency on homelessness. What will that do to fight this chronic problem that seems to have gotten worse during the pandemic?
Well, absolutely. It did get worse. The population exploded of people who are on our streets. You know, one of the things that is critically important that will be addressed in the declaration is to have a citywide unified strategy and to have a strategy that's done in conjunction with the county. And essentially, it puts the general managers on notice that they are to get back to us right away about all available city property where housing can be built immediately. It will fast track through a lot of the process and red tape that results in housing costing so much money and taking so long to be built. In the next couple of days, we're going to announce another urgent matter, and that is going to be called Inside Safe. And that is going to be a citywide strategy to get people out of tents and into homes. And the first homes we're going to look at will be in motels and hotels while temporary and permanent supportive housing is being built. You know, to build anything, even in the best of circumstances, it takes months. We don't want people lingering on the street while we're getting housing built, which is why we're going to master lease from hotels and motels.
And Los Angeles, as you say, is unaffordable for so many families. Realtor.com says the median home price is now $1 million. What are your plans for making both buying and renting more affordable, Mayor?
Well, what we absolutely have to do is build more housing, but we can't build all of the housing in two or three neighborhoods. Everyone in the city is going to have skin in the game. And the best way to do that is for neighborhoods to get together and determine themselves where housing should be built. And not just new housing, but converting commercial units into housing, adding units onto existing housing. We have to use every different possible way to get people housed.
You know, we've all heard about the NIMBY movement, the not in your backyard or not in my backyard movement. How do you plan to win over the many Angelenos who don't want to see people who are unhoused or even have them live in their neighborhood?
Well, one of the reasons why I said it's so important for neighborhoods to get together and decide where housing should be built, what I think people object to more than anything is an outside force coming in and redesigning their neighborhoods. And so there's some neighborhoods I've been to that are very adamant. They do not want to see apartment buildings mixed in with single family homes, but they point to some of the commercial areas where housing can be built. So they didn't object to everything. They had an alternative proposal.
Let me switch gears. Long-term tensions between Black and Latino communities were exposed through leaked conversations among former and current city council members that involved racist comments. You are known as a coalition builder. How do you plan to mend that rift or ease the tensions in these communities of Los Angeles?
I actually reject the notion, because there is tension between individuals in any communities and all communities. I don't think there's anything any particular or special about Black-Brown communities, especially in South LA, because Black and Brown folks live next door to each other. And there are many of us who have been building alliances with each other for decades. And so I don't believe that a conversation between four individuals erases work that has been going on for generations. And so, but what I did do, my reaction when I heard the tapes, and of course, I thought it was horrible, is that I immediately convened a community meeting with leaders from all around the city, and I called upon them to initiate a series of discussions all around Los Angeles. Number one, talking about the problems, but also talking about the solutions. And what we heard on those tapes were not just about African Americans and Latinos. It was pretty much everybody.
I want to ask you specifically about the African-American community in Los Angeles. Median household wealth is staggeringly low. African-Americans are also very overrepresented in the unhoused, the unemployed, and the incarcerated populations. Do you plan to do anything specifically to address this?
Well, first of all, you just described why I ran. Is because that extreme disproportionality, just to be specific, African Americans are 8 to 9% of the city's population, but 30 or more percent of the unhoused. And so absolutely there needs to be specific attention paid to specific groups. The other thing that happened in the last count is a huge increase in Latino homelessness. And so we need to get to the bottom of that. What I have always believed is that for different populations, you do have to have specific strategies. We have to get to the bottom of why Latino homelessness shot up so much in the last year. I think a lot of work has been done about African-American homelessness. Reports have been specifically done so we know what the issues are, and we have to address those issues head on. And at the center of those issues is basic discrimination, racial discrimination in housing.
And would you consider creating a task force that might address some of the harms specifically to Black Angelenos in the area of household family wealth?
Well, one of the things that I think is important is there's no need to recreate the wheel. I don't know if I would do a task force like that because I think a lot of work has already been done. And I would rather build on the work that has been done. So, for example, a couple of years ago, there was a task force specifically looking at that and looking at Black homelessness. Rather than create another task force, that task force came up with very specific recommendations that I need to review, discuss with the people that put the report together, and see if anything has changed.
Got it. Los Angeles is a city where the Defund the Police movement gained steam. There are communities, however, that feel over-policed but still unsafe. I wonder what your plan is for these Angelenos.
My plan involves creating an Office of Community Safety, and that Office of Community Safety will go around the city to different neighborhoods and ask neighborhoods, what do they need in order to feel safe? So the neighborhoods that you're talking about tend to want more investment in community programs, after-school programs, youth programs, jobs. In communities like South Central LA and East LA, people are interested in addressing the root causes of crime. And in many instances, it's health, it's social, and it's economic.
I'd love to ask you, because you're the first female and the second African-American mayor of Los Angeles. And there's another big first. For the first time, our nation's four biggest cities are led by African-American mayors in New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, and Houston. What's the significance of that?
Well, I will tell you that a few days ago, I got a very nice text message from the other three mayors inviting me to do a Zoom call with them. And we actually are working on an op-ed piece that hopefully one of the major national newspapers will pick up. It is very significant, and each city is facing very similar problems. But we are beginning to work together right now.
If I may, can I ask you a more personal question? Your daughter and son-in-law, 23-year-old newlyweds, Amelia and Michael, died in a car accident in 2006, and you mentioned them in your inaugural address. How do you process tragedy? And does it give you a particular perspective that may inform how you'll govern the nation's second biggest city?
Well, you know, I mean, I'm like, unfortunately, belong to a club that many parents belong to who have lost their children. And it colors everything you do in life after that. Your life is profoundly changed forever. And how I process it, I just know that my daughter and son-in-law would fully expect for me to do exactly what I'm doing. They would want me to carry on. They would want me to focus on those who have least among us. And that's how I have led my life. Their presence is still very much alive with me. It makes me sensitive to other parents who've lost their children and other people who are going through the grieving process that actually never ends.
You know, we started our conversation with the challenges that Los Angeles faces. Crime is also a concern, homelessness, affordable housing. I want to ask you where you find hope and beauty in the city's future.
I find hope and beauty everywhere. I think that people in the city are anxious to move forward, anxious to come together. And that, to me, is the essence of hope, gives me the inspiration and encouragement to know that we can address our problems.
We've been talking with the new mayor of Los Angeles, Karen Bass. Mayor Bass, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, fusion power. It's not just for SimCity 2000 anymore. Stick around.
America has achieved a tremendous scientific breakthrough, one that happened because we invested in our national labs.
That's Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm today celebrating a feat that scientists have been trying to accomplish for decades. For the first time ever, physicists at Lawrence Livermore National Lab in California got more energy out of a fusion reaction than they put in. More specifically, they shot the world's biggest laser at a tiny pellet of hydrogen plasma and fused its atoms together, unleashing energy. There are a few caveats, and we'll get to those in Robin Young's conversation with one of the scientists behind the feat. Omar Hurricane is a distinguished scientist at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory and a member of the team that worked to achieve this breakthrough.
Omar, we note, Hurricane is your real name. You didn't adopt it for this groundbreaking day?
I did not adopt it. My father did.
Well, it's appropriate because you are blowing through with this news. And, you know, for decades we've been hearing about the promise of fusion. And simply put, bear with me, this is how stars are made. You know, atoms of hydrogen fuse and they create helium, and some of the hydrogen then turns into clean energy. Have I got that right?
Yeah, basically, fusion is the process by which stars and our sun make the energy that we feel as heat and light in the sky. And it involves fusing atoms of hydrogen into heavier atomic elements.
Right.
So we have been trying to do something similar here on Earth, the fusion community, for about 50 or 60 years.
And that energy that comes off is called clean energy. It doesn't have, like, the side effect of, let's say, coal energy. Why has it been so hard to create and capture that clean energy?
Yeah, well, creating it requires you to reproduce conditions in the laboratory that are as extreme or more extreme than exist in the center of the sun. Yeah. So you can kind of imagine that's why it's so hard. That's
This is your office, after all. Well, we know the more than 190 lasers that were used to do that targeted this tiny bit of hydrogen fuel to make this clean energy. They required a huge amount of electricity to operate. You know, the lasers did. This is electricity. So there was, you know, waste from that. That's dirty energy. Is that the problem right now? How to use even less energy to create this small amount of clean energy that's coming off?
That is the problem for practical energy production. The problem until this point is just getting to these various tipping points of getting the fusion reaction to start powering itself. And that's what has been the focus of fusion research for many decades, just trying to get the science and the physics right. Mm. Now, you're right, we do have this issue where the laser consumes a huge amount of electricity, far more than it produced in laser energy that was shot at our target, and far more energy than we got back from the fusion reactions. So what's required is that we now need to do engineering to improve these laser systems so that they're more energy efficient, while also improving the design and engineering of our target physics package to get it to be more efficient and produce more energy for the energy we put in. And we call that ratio target energy gain,
right,
which is basically how much energy we gain as compared to what we shot at the target.
Right, and how much waste might have been. I mean, you know, we think of nuclear energy, but there's a terrible byproduct from nuclear energy. So this is that sense, right, of trying to get a cleaner energy but use less dirty energy to get to it. What? How long do you
there,
think?
There is,
oh, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, there is an important distinction between nuclear fusion energy and nuclear fission energy. Mm-hmm. Nuclear fission involves splitting atoms that are high up on the periodic table, and when they fission, they release energy, and a lot of radioactivity is associated with nuclear fission. For us, on the nuclear fusion side, what we're doing is combining light elements into heavier ones, and that also happens to produce energy. And that does not produce any radioactivity directly, although it does produce neutrons, which can activate other materials. So there's still some practical considerations with regards to radioactivity.
Omar Hurricane, all morning I've been reading up on fission and fusion and, you know, reminding myself of how big a deal this is. So we hope to have you back again to talk about progress and, you know, getting towards your goals. Thank you so much for talking to us about it.
It's been a pleasure talking to you as well.
Coming up next, we're sharing a recipe from a listener. Her family's special fish curry. Stick around and maybe grab a snack during the break. NPR has been sharing listeners' family recipes this holiday season. Today, we've got one from Sujata Halankar in Yuma, Arizona. And it reminded Deepa of one of her favorite family recipes for a South Indian prawn curry. That's where they started their conversation.
So I have to tell you that my family comes from the same coastal region of India your family is from, Konkan, and my producer Kalyani is also Konkani. So between you, me, and Kalyani, we've got a lot of fish curries in our family.
Yes, and it's really nice to know that you are from the same region.
Yes, and so tell us about the women in your family and this recipe.
Yeah, so this recipe is, I call it generational recipe. My grandmother started cooking it. My mom's mother started cooking it. And it's nothing very fancy. The ingredients are very basic, locally available ingredients like coconut, garlic, green chilies, onions, and chili powder, coriander powder, and that's about it, you know. And we are from the region where we grow a lot of coconut, so coconut is part of pretty much all the recipes, you know.
You know, I wanted to ask you about that because I grew up watching the women in my family sit on a little box with a blade at the end of it and crack those coconuts in half and scrape the meat out.
Yes, I know. I have it here. I got it from India.
I know. And we bring them with us when we immigrate. My mom did it in Sydney, Australia. So do you scrape your own coconuts, Sujata?
I used to very regularly, but now I just buy fresh frozen coconut. It's available now in Indian stores.
It got so easy thanks to the Indian stores. So your grandma used to make this curry for you every summer vacation. I'd love to hear some of your favorite memories of eating this in her home when you would go back for the summer.
Yes. So every summer, my mom would just pack up us and we four sisters, and we would spend our summer in Ratnagiri. That's where we are from originally. And what happened is, like, my grandma, my grandparents were there, my uncles and aunts, they were there too. And so we used to have, like, such a great time. Their house was by the beach. So all the memories of, like, carefree childhood and spending time on the beach, collecting seashells and drinking fresh coconut water. And, of course, because it was summer, the mango season, the famous Alfonso mango, you know. And so my grandmother would, of course, when we arrived there, she would cook for us every day. And then this fish curry is like a staple in the family, you know. So
yeah, I have to say, reading your recipe and seeing that you ate it with mangoes to try and, you know, mitigate some of the spice and have that, it just brought back so many of my childhood memories as well. But I want to ask you about the fish that you put in your fish curry, because my family's from Mangalore, which is about 500 kilometers south of Ratnagiri, where your family's from. And we use a white fish called pomfret, which here in the US I think is butterfish or pompano. But you use salmon or trout. What did your grandmother use when you were growing up?
So I don't know the names for the fish, but basically we use surmai. And mackerel. And so these are the kind of fish, and the prawns also.
Yes, and prawns, as I mentioned, prawn curry and fish curry, you can interchange them with the same curry base. But let's talk about the chilies for a moment. So your recipe calls for green chilies. It's so gorgeous. My family uses a blend of red chilies. Tell me about how you manage the spice level. If the people that you're cooking for can't take it super hot.
Right. So we use green chilies only for garnishing and in the beginning. But the base is red chili. You can either make with fresh red chilies, like a dry red chilies, but my family, they have this spice mix with red chili powder, red chilies and coriander seeds. So we kind of make it the whole year of stock of this spices and that we use for our fish curry.
Oh, my family too. I think we're the same people, Sujata. We use a we use a powder called Bafath powder, which your recipe made me ask my aunties and my mom about them and triggered some great memories for me. I'm just wondering if we can end with you giving us one of your favorite memories of eating this fish curry growing up.
Yeah, so as soon as we arrive to Ratnagiri, and then my grandma would serve this with a steaming hot rice, and then we would like complain about spicy level, and then the fresh mangoes would come.
Ooh.
And it's the greatest combination. You must try sometime.
Absolutely.
Steamed rice, fish curry, and ripe mangoes. You know?
You have heard it, listeners. Fish curry and ripe mangoes. Though, Sujata, we must lament that our listeners will probably never eat as good a mango as an Alfonso.
Yes, no.
we have to say they are some of the best. Thank you so much for sharing your recipe with us, Sujata.
Thank you so much, Deepa, and thank you for the opportunity to share my recipe with everyone. I hope a lot of people try it.
Of course, we'll have Sujata Halankar's recipe for delicious fish curry available at hereandnow.org. By the way, while you're in the kitchen, check out another story from today's show about what those use-by and best-by dates on your perishables really mean.
We're scared, right? You see a date on food and you're worried, oh my gosh, I'm not supposed to eat it after that. It might make me sick. But in fact, those dates are not about safety. They're really trying to tell us when the product's at its top quality. And so many foods can be eaten well past those dates.
You can find that conversation and a lot more at hereandnow.org. This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now, from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories were produced by Shirley Jihad, Todd Munt, and Kalyani Saxena. Todd Munt and Gabe Bullard edited the show. Technical direction from Max Liebman and Patrick O'Connor. Theme music by me, Max, and Mike Moschetto. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.